Thompson. And could we have the bailiff, can you signal the clerk's office to? Okay, good. Thank you. Ms. Wade, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Zoe Wade and I represent the appellant, Benjamin Thompson. He is appealing his conviction based on improper admission of evidence of blood test result, as well as the district court's erroneous refusal to recuse itself. I'm asking that this court remand this case back down with directions for the district court to enter an order of recusal and that the matter be set for a new trial. I'd like to begin by commenting on an important distinction in the law between probable cause for an arrest, that is probable cause to believe that an individual has committed an offense, and probable cause for a search, that is probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime is likely to be located in the place to be searched. Probable cause to arrest, once it is formed, it continues unabated in perpetuity. So, for example, when an arrest warrant is issued, it doesn't expire, it doesn't lapse. It hangs out for weeks, months, years, however long it takes for that individual to be apprehended. However, probable cause to believe that evidence will be found does not continue in perpetuity. Evidence can be moved.
How long does it continue?
It depends on it is determined by the character of the evidence. So it can be moved, it can be destroyed. I think DNA evidence has found to be rather persistent, so a search warrant based on information that can be up to a couple of years old might still support a warrant to search. But in this particular case, we're talking about alcohol in the bloodstream, which is a rapidly dissipating, event. And as it evaporates out of the blood, which we know occurs within a matter of hours, so too does probable cause to believe that alcohol would be located if an individual's blood was searched. And as a result, when we're talking about probable cause for a search, proof of probable cause justifying the issuance of a search warrant must consist of facts that are so closely related in time of the issuance of the warrant as to justify a finding of probable cause at that time. That is the law of this jurisdiction, and as far as I can tell, every jurisdiction. And that's why when a search warrant is issued, it's limited in duration. Similar to, in this case, typically a matter of days, in this case, it's 10 days. Questionable, but that's, search warrants are not unlimited.
So is there a date in the warrant?
There is not. There's not a date, nor is there a time. The information that is set forth in the application for the search warrant contains entirely undated information. For that reason, I'm asking this court to reverse the district court's order denying my motion.
There is a date, isn't there?
Pardon me?
There is a date, isn't there?
There's a date that the application was submitted. The underlying information is not dated. This court has held since 1999 that the events described in an affidavit, if they are undated, they cannot be considered in determining whether or not probable cause to search exists. That has been the holding of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals since 1981. That is clearly established that the evidence has to establish a temporal connection between the facts alleged and the probability that evidence will be found. And that is why the warrant is entirely defective on its face in this case. Since Birchfield versus
North Dakota. With the date on the warrant and it being a warrant for a blood draw, can't the judge
Infer? Absolutely not. And the best discussion of that is in United States versus Button. There was information, and it's highly relevant in part because it didn't contain completely undated information as we have in this particular case. The information was that the officer had received information from a confidential informant over a period of about 6 months. There was also an assertion that they had, that the subject of that investigation was currently supplying fencyclidine to a person who was close to the informant, or PCP. Even with those...
So is any of that really relevant in a blood draw case?
Absolutely, because the timing is so much more critical because the evidence is so much more fleeting in the case of a blood draw. You are not likely to have probable cause to believe that alcohol will be in your blood system even 24 hours after you're operating a motor vehicle, probable cause will have evaporated. It will have evaporated after approximately 12 hours. 8 hours, most likely, no basis for thinking that if you did a search 8 hours later, that you were likely to uncover evidence of alcohol in the bloodstream. Even after 4, 5, 6 hours, you're getting into questionable territory, and this court has recognized that previously in State versus Kubik, an opinion from 1990. In some cases, the delay may be so substantial as to render the test results non-probative of the accused's impairment or breath alcohol level while driving. Because of the fleeting nature, the failure to include this information is even more problematic for the state. But you can look to the Eighth Circuit opinion that specifically considered and rejected a government's argument that the court should simply infer that the evidence, the information in the affidavit was timely. And the court noted that permitting courts to simply infer that events set forth in an affidavit are sufficiently timely to establish probable cause would be to open the door to unsupervised issuance of search warrants on the basis of aging information, allowing officers with information of questionable recency to escape embarrassment by simply omitting averments as to time. There's a strong policy reason not to permit courts to infer this information, and it is the established precedent in this jurisdiction. And for that reason, and because it has existed for so long, that an objectively, reasonably trained officer should know that the facts have to establish a temporal proximity between the facts alleged and the time that the warrant is sought. And in this case, you have an allegation of a car accident. Not only is it not dated, there's no time. You don't know if this is 2 hours, 4 hours, 10 hours, 26 hours, or 2 years ago. It's simply not stated. And when we're reviewing a search warrant, we are confined to the four corners of that search warrant, and there is absolutely no information from which the court can reasonably infer. And the state argues, as this court has suggested, that it's easily inferred and that it is apparent that the warrant was executed the same day. Even if you could infer that, which you cannot, but if you could, 24 hours is not sufficient to allow a magistrate to determine whether or not probable cause exists. And the reason why these information needs to be set forth in the affidavit is because the determination is not supposed to be made by the officer. It's supposed to be made, the officer is supposed to supply the information to the magistrate so that they can make their own determination of whether or not probable cause is likely to exist. I would argue that since the law on that issue is so well established and a reasonable officer should know that that is in fact the law, that the good faith exception simply does not apply in that case. It cannot be, it is objectively unreasonable for a reasonably trained officer with knowledge of what the law requires to act on a warrant where there's no averment as to when in time the underlying events occurred. Turning to the Franks versus Delaware motion, I'll try to be brief because the state essentially concedes the myriad deficiencies in this warrant, the false representations as well as the glaring omissions of fact, including the fact that this particular officer's statement concerning his training and experience would naturally lead the reviewing court to determine that he was in fact the person who conducted this DUI investigation when he was not. Now the state argues that this remaining remaining information is nonetheless sufficient because there was nonetheless, if you excise all of that improperly included information, you still have information that Mr. Thompson operated a motor vehicle that was involved in an accident, that he smelled of alcohol, that he admitted drinking, and that he was taken to a hospital. But again, none of these facts are dated. They're not properly before a court for their consideration. And I believe that the state relies on those decisions such as State versus Huff, State versus Wagner, State versus Gransinger. And it's important because those cases all predate Birchfield versus North Dakota. So in State versus Huff, for example, this court noted that you had little difficulty concluding that despite the lack of field sobriety tests or a preliminary breath test, there was ample evidence establishing probable cause to arrest Huff and reasonable grounds to demand a blood test. Well, prior to Birchfield, that's all that was required. Those cases speak to probable cause or an arrest for drunk driving prior to Birchfield, they do not address the temporal requirement. The statutory scheme in effect when those decisions were rendered was that if there was reasonable suspicion to suspect an individual was driving under the influence, that a motorist, by statute, consented to a test of their blood. That is no longer the law. That authority is no longer relevant to the issues that are currently before this court.
Is there evidence of intoxication outside of the blood draw?
There is, and I'm glad you mentioned that because the state does speak to, I guess, does argue that even if this evidence was erroneously admitted, that there's nonetheless harmless error should prevail in this particular case. And if I may just finish my response, there is evidence that there was alcohol in the car. There is evidence that he was disposing of alcohol at the time, all of those, and there was evidence that there was alcohol on his breath. All signs of drinking, not signs of impairment. There is evidence that he had a pill bottle and that not all of the pills were contained in the bottle and that he took his prescription medication that morning. The testimony of the other driver involved in this collision was identical. He also had a central nervous system depressant medication that was prescribed to him that he took that morning that he was carrying with him in his vehicle that day. He testified under oath, as probably most of us can relate to, that when he travels, he doesn't carry all of his pills with him. The state tried to imply that this meant that Mr. Thompson had therefore consumed much more of his prescribed medication than was specifically, I guess, directed by his physician, but there are the evidence that wasn't submitted, and I will concede that there is evidence of intoxication, that it's not, that there is some evidence to sustain the verdict. It is absolutely nowhere near that which would be required for this court to find that the admission of a
What about driving away from the scene of an accident while your car is scraping the road and you've nearly killed your three daughters?
The evidence that was presented from the statements of my client was that he was attempting in his state of mind to take his daughter to a hospital. That's what he represented to the other driver. That's what the other driver told law enforcement when they arrived, was that his attempt was to drive this badly damaged vehicle because he was concerned for the safety of his daughter. All I'm saying is that there is evidence in conflict and that it is not so overwhelming. And I would note when they indicate that they're, first of all, the state has argued also that there's evidence of bloodshot eyes and slurred speech. That was not relayed to the officer. That doesn't appear anywhere in the warrant. That's information that wasn't drummed up until the time of trial based on the officers who were obviously very, whose ability to conduct a DUI investigation was obviously very questionable at best.
But that might be pertinent to the harmless error analysis. Right.
That is what I'm speaking of. And I would also note that they had testified that notwithstanding they had not properly performed the field sobriety test, that they nonetheless saw signs or observed signs of impairment. But the district court, in denying my motions, specifically observed that it may well be that because of his injuries, which required transportation to a hospital, the defendant's field test results might be completely eliminated. This is an individual who had just been in an accident, who had substantial visual impairment issues and substantial issues affecting his balance and his ability to walk, two herniated discs. He was undergoing treatment, physical therapy, and spinal injections at the time that can account for many of these things. I'm not saying that the evidence is that there is no evidence. I'm simply saying it's not sufficient that you could reasonably conclude that in a trial for driving under the influence that the jury did not consider the blood alcohol test result.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
This is Ward, David Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellate, State of Nebraska. I will follow suit and address the denial of the motion to suppress and then the denial of the Frank's motion, and then I will, if time permits, also briefly address the potential issue of plain error on the sentencing, because I think we actually have errors beyond what I noted in our brief. As far as the denial of the motion to suppress the blood draw, I would start by reiterating that when a search occurs pursuant to a search warrant, it is the defendant's burden to show the warrant was invalid. I maintain that Thompson has failed to meet that burden in this case, so the motion to suppress was properly denied. The thrust of Thompson's argument is that the search warrant here was defective because it failed to set forth the date and the time frame of the incident in question, which he claims negated probable cause for the blood draw. We obviously disagree. As set forth in our brief, both this court and the U.S. Supreme Court explain that search warrants are to be read in a common sense manner and as a whole, including reasonable drawn.
So how do you do that in this case?
Well, in this case...
There is no time, for example, as to when the accident happened, is that correct?
That's correct. But when we look at the information in the search warrant affidavit, it does contain the date for which this affidavit was prepared. It notes that the defendant was involved in a hit-and-run accident involving a critical injury to a passenger. He smelled of alcohol, he admitted he'd been drinking, and he was seeking a blood draw to assist in the prosecution of a DUI. I would submit, in light of all of that information, the only logical inference, especially given the dissipation of alcohol, the only logical inference is that the accident, incident being investigated, occurred closely in time to when this search warrant happened.
How do you respond to the cases cited by opposing counsel that would seem to be that the court should not infer dates?
Well, there's plenty of case law, which we readily concede, that says, if you've got a potential problem with stale evidence, or we just simply can't put together a time frame, then inferences aren't going to allow you to cross that bridge. I mean, that's well established. I'm not disputing that. But it's equally well established that inferences can be drawn in these things. And, I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court itself has said that we don't review these things in a hyper-technical manner. They're often drafted hastily and by non-lawyers. So, I mean, we need to... Mistakes do happen, and if there's a permissible inference, it is permissible to draw that inference. And that's...
Is there anything in the record about when the officer went to a magistrate to get the warrant, when that was done? And is that something we can take into consideration?
There was testimony to that effect at the suppression hearing, the suppression/Franks hearing. That's not in the four corners of the search warrant affidavit, but to the extent that you could consider that as part of a good faith consideration, you could on the suppression issue. Good faith is always a fair game. I'm certainly not waiving that argument. To the extent Tompkins requires me to make it, I am asserting it to the extent this court finds that it applies. But I would acknowledge that I stayed away from expressly arguing good faith in this case. Given the interplay of the search warrant and the Franks hearing here, I mean, one classic example of when we don't have good faith is when we have information that has been, inaccurate information that has been provided, whether intentionally or recklessly, good faith won't apply. And that would be more in the Franks context here, but given the interplay, I just opted to stay away from the issue altogether. But to answer your question, yes, I think in the context of the denial of the motion to suppress on that question of the date and time, you could look at beyond the four.
Doesn't the jurat of the affidavit show when the oath was administered?
I don't believe it.
Doesn't say on such and such a date?
Oh, yes. Yes, it does contain that, yes. But not a time. Our position is that permissible inference there would provide the necessary date and time frame, but in any event, alternatively, as set forth in our brief, we would submit that any error in the admission of the blood draw was harmless, given the other properly admitted, and what we would submit was overwhelming evidence of intoxication at the time of the wreck.
There's a file stamp on the affidavit, has the date, but no time.
Correct.
Would adopting your argument create some incentives to leave out the time in future marginal cases?
I don't know why law enforcement would ever have incentive to leave things out.
Well, say it's a case where we're nearing the point of evidence dissipation. A probable cause is marginal. If we adopt your rule, would that set up an incentive to say, well, we can leave out the time because then the court will infer that it was close enough to allow the search?
Well, I mean, an officer could try that, but the risk is not worth the reward there. I don't see why you'd do that. I mean, sure, it's conceivable, but I've never seen anything of that nature, and I just can't conceive of why you would do that. You do your due diligence and put all the information in there, explain why it's relevant. That to me would be the essence of bad faith. Saying, well, this is a close call. I'm not really sure that we even have probable cause here, so let's just draft this as broadly and as vaguely as possible so we can maybe get away with a stale warrant. Uh, I I mean, that's clearly not what we have here, and to the extent...
Is there anything unique about blood draws in alcohol situations that sort of imply or infer that the incident had to be reasonably close to the time they took it to the magistrate?
Yeah, that's the very essence of my argument, that this can be inferred. If you had a different situation, many other situations, you wouldn't be able to draw that inference. But given that, I mean, I agree with what Ms. Wade is saying on how quickly alcohol dissipates, and I think that's precisely why the inference is warranted here, because if we were 24, 48 hours out, they aren't going to be seeking a warrant to get a blood draw. I mean, there would be no point. So the fact that they were necessarily tells us that they were close enough in time to think that there could be some value to obtaining that blood draw. I think that's precisely why the inference is warranted here.
Isn't your problem here that the officer was using a form of some kind? Do we know the source of this form? And should this court be putting an imprimatur on what appears to be very sloppy work?
This was not a good warrant, Your Honor. I'm not going to sit here and say that it was in any way. I readily acknowledge this warrant was as bad as any warrant I've ever seen. To the extent you feel it necessary to comment on it, sure, because it shouldn't happen again. I don't want to stray from the record, but I know that things are going to be, or have been, shored up in Douglas County in light of this case. Yeah, this shouldn't happen. I'm not a fan of this checklist type warrant. I think it's sometimes what is used, especially in these DUI cases, because they are trying to act so quickly, and I think that Birchfield didn't quite anticipate all of the problems with getting warrants, especially these types of circumstances, and that's why we're sometimes seeing it. And when they're going to start doing electronic warrants, if that's necessary, checklist form warrants might be all you can do if you're trying to submit something electronically within a matter of minutes. But nonetheless, it doesn't excuse, you know, the inaccuracies and the omissions. I'm not going to stand here and defend that, Your Honor. Our argument with respect to that and the Franks issue, though, is that take all of that into account, all of the inaccuracies and all of the omissions. The search warrant at bottom still provided probable cause for the blood draw. It still provided that there was a hit-and-run accident. He smelled of alcohol. He admitted he'd been drinking. They wanted it for a DUI prosecution, I think. That still provided probable cause to get the blood draw. As we noted in our brief, this court has repeatedly held that evidence of that nature was sufficient for a DUI arrest, even in the absence of PBTs or FSTs. So I guess the way I see it is, I mean, even if you take all that out altogether, say there were no field sobriety tests and there was no PBT in this case, I think the information we have on its own was still sufficient. And all of that information don't affect by the deficiency. So I think when you take that remaining information, it still provided probable cause. And then again, on the Franks issue, alternatively, we would submit that even if that blood draw was improperly admitted, the admission was harmless in light of the other properly admitted evidence of intoxication in this case.
Go over that list that you think is sufficient, even if we say that the blood draw should have been suppressed.
The harmless error evidence?
Right.
He flees from the scene, goes to a park, he's discarding alcohol, including two bottles of beer and a half-empty bottle of whiskey. He opened a beer cans in his car, one of which was empty, a full bottle of whiskey in there. He had a bottle, if I could continue, maybe
you may.
Just a little bit. Had a bottle of lorazepam in his car, which according to the label had been prescribed 6 days earlier. It said take one pill every 8 hours, yet only 12 of the 60 were remaining. Smelled of alcohol, had bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, repeatedly said he was not fucked up while they were just trying to talk with him and get biographical information. Showed impairment on field sobriety tests, which admittedly were not done perfectly, but the officers testified still were valid to show some impairment. Admitted he took both his prescriptions earlier that day and said he was still feeling the effects of his prescriptions when he was interviewed approximately 3 hours after the wreck. Gave inconsistent explanations about where he was going and where he lived. I couldn't seem to recall his own address. And then both Officers Andrews and Petrowski, who were both with him for approximately 4 hours that day, testified that, in their opinion, he was intoxicated based on all of their observations. So I would submit that that evidence, viewed collectively, among other evidence in this case, would lead to the conclusion that even if that blood draw should not have come in, that the error was harmless. And the verdict was nonetheless supported by the evidence in this case.
You alluded to plain error beyond that raised in your brief.
Yeah.
Please elaborate.
Sure. Beyond the 15 revocations I noted, I was also looking at the sentencing order yesterday, and it appears that on counts 2, 3, 4, and 5, the court imposed a determinate sentence. Those needed to be indeterminate since count 1 was a Class 2A felony requiring an indeterminate sentence. Since that one had to be indeterminate, the others did as well. I didn't have a chance to check the BOE out again and look at the oral pronouncement. That could have been correct. The court might have pronounced valid indeterminate sentences. I don't know. And perhaps the Truth in Sentencing Advisement could shore that up as well. Again, I didn't have time to an opportunity to review that. But if that's not shored up, I think that would be plain error. And I think the appropriate remedy here then would have to be to reverse and remand for resentencing valid indeterminate sentences to those. There are no further questions. Thank you. That's the affirmative judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We do not. That takes us to the